She collapsed into my arms, weeping hysterically, and scattering herbs. I clutched her against my shoulder and patted her, making small shushing noises, though I shed a few tears myself that fell unnoticed into the dark shininess of her hair. "You'll see him again," I whispered. "Of course you will. It won't make a difference to him. He's a good man." But I knew it would. I had seen the anguish on Alex Randall's face the night before, and at the time thought it only the same helpless pity for suffering that I saw in Jamie and Myrtle. But since I had learned of Alex Randall's professed love for Mary, I had realized how much deeper his own pain must go, and his fear. He seemed a good man, but he was also a poor younger son, in ill health, and with little chance of advancement. What position he did have was entirely dependent on the Duke of Sandringham's goodwill, and I had little hope that the Duke would look kindly on the idea of his secretary's union with a disgraced and ruined girl, who had now neither social connections nor dowry to bless herself with. And if Alex found somewhere the courage to wed her in spite of everything, what chance would they have? Penniless, cast out of polite society, and with the hideous fact of the rape overshadowing their knowledge of each other. There was nothing I could do but hold her and weep with her for what was lost. It was twilight by the time I left, with the first stars coming out in faint speckles over the chimney pots. In my pocket was a letter written by Mary, properly witnessed, containing her statement of the events of the night before. Once this was delivered to the proper authorities, we should at least have no further trouble from the law. Just as well. There was plenty of trouble pending from other quarters. Mindful this time of danger, I made no objection to Mrs. Hawkins' unwilling offer to have me and Fergus transported home in the family carriage. I tossed my hat on the card table in the vestibule, observing the large number of notes and small nosegays that overflowed the salver there. Apparently we weren't yet pariahs, though the news of the scandal must long since have spread through the social strata of Paris. I waved away the anxious inquiries of the servants, and drifted upward toward the bedchamber, shedding my outer garments carelessly along the way. I felt too drained to care about anything. But when I pushed open the bedchamber door and saw Jamie lying back in a chair by the fire, my apathy was at once supplanted by a surge of tenderness. His eyes were closed, and his hair sticking up in all directions, sure sign of mental turmoil at some point. But he opened his eyes at the slight noise of my entrance, and smiled at me, eyes clear and blue in the warm light of the candelabrum. "That's all right," was all he whispered to me as he gathered me into his arms. "You're home." Then we were silent as we undressed each other and went finally to earth, each finding delayed and wordless sanctuary in the other's embrace. Chapter 21. Untimely Resurrection. My mind was still on bankers when our coach pulled up to the Duke's rented residence on the Rue Sainte-Anne. It was a large, handsome house, with a long, curving drive lined with poplar trees and extensive grounds. A wealthy man, the Duke. "Do you suppose it was the loan Charles got from Manzetti that he's investing with Saint-Germain?" I asked.
"That must be," Jamie replied.
He pulled on the pigskin gloves suitable for a formal call, grimacing slightly as he smoothed the tight leather over the stiff fourth finger of his right hand.
"The money his father thinks he's spending to maintain himself in Paris."
"So Charles really is trying to raise money for an army," I said, feeling a reluctant admiration for Charles Stuart. The coach came to a halt, and the footman hopped down to open the door.
"Well, he's trying to raise money, at least," Jamie corrected, handing me out of the coach. "For all I care, he wants it to elope with Louise de la Tour and his bastard."
I shook my head.
"I don't think so. Not from what Master Raymond told me yesterday. Besides, Louise says she hasn't seen him since she and Jules... Well...
Jamie snorted briefly.
At least she's got some sense of honour, then.
I don't know whether that's it, I observed, taking his arm as we climbed the steps to the door. She said Charles was so furious at her for sleeping with her husband that he stormed off and she hasn't seen him since. He writes her passionate letters from time to time, swearing to come and take her and the child away with him as soon as he comes into his rightful place in the world. But she won't let him come to see her. She's too afraid of Jules finding out the truth.
Jamie made a disapproving Scottish noise.
God, is there any man safe from cuckoldry?
I touched his arm lightly.
Likely some more than others.
You think so?
He said, but smiled down at me. The door swung open to reveal a short, tubby butler with a bald head, a spotless uniform, and immense dignity.
"Milor," he said, bowing to Jamie, "and milady, you are expected. Please come in."
The Duke was charm itself as he received us in the main drawing room.
"Nonsense, nonsense," he said, dismissing Jamie's apologies for the contretemps of the dinner party. "Damned excitable fellows, the French. Make an ungodly fuss over everything. Now, do let us look over all these fascinating propositions, shall we? And perhaps your good lady would like to, amuse herself with a perusal of,
He waved an arm vaguely in the direction of the wall, leaving it open to question whether I might amuse myself by looking at the several large paintings, the well-furnished bookshelf, or the several glass cases in which the Duke's collection of snuff-boxes resided.
"Thank you,"
I murmured, with a charming smile, and wandered over to the wall, pretending to be absorbed in a large boucher, featuring the back view of an amply endowed nude woman seated on a rock in the wilderness. If this was a reflection of current tastes in female anatomy, it was no wonder that Jamie appeared to think so highly of my bottom.
"Ah," I said, "what price foundation garments, eh?"
"Eh?"
Jamie and the Duke, startled, looked up from the portfolio of investment papers that formed the ostensible reason for our visit.
"Never mind me," I said, waving a gracious hand, "just enjoying the art." "I'm deeply gratified, ma'am," said the Duke politely, and at once re-immersed himself in the papers as Jamie began the tedious and painstaking real business of the visit, the inconspicuous extraction of such information as the Duke might be willing to part with regarding his own sympathies, or otherwise, toward the Stuart cause. I had my own agenda for this visit as well.
As the men became more immersed in their discussions, I edged my way toward the door, pretending to look through the well-furnished shelves. As soon as the coast looked clear, I meant to slip out into the hallway and try to find Alex Randall. I had done what I could to repair the damage done to Mary Hawkins. Anything further would have to come from him. Under the rules of social etiquette, he couldn't call upon her at her uncle's house, nor could she contact him. But I could easily make an opportunity for them to meet at the Rue Trémoulin. The conversation behind me had dropped to a confidential murmur. I stuck my head into the hall, but didn't see a footman immediately.
Still, one couldn't be far away. A house of this size must have a staff numbering in the dozens.
As large as it was, I would need directions in order to locate Alexander Randall. I chose a direction at random and walked along the hallway, looking for a servant of whom to inquire. I saw a flicker of motion at the end of the hall and called out. Whoever it was made no answer, but I heard a surreptitious scuttle of feet on polished boards.
That seemed curious behaviour for a servant.
I stopped at the end of the hall and looked around. Another hall extended at right angles to the one I stood in, lined on one side with doors, on the other with long windows that opened on the drive and the garden. Most of the doors were closed, but the one closest to me was slightly ajar. Moving quietly, I stepped up to it and put my ear next to the panelling. Hearing nothing, I took hold of the handle and boldly pushed the door open.
"What in the name of God are you doing here?" I exclaimed in astonishment. "Oh, you scared me. Gracious, I thought I was going to die."
Mary Hawkins pressed both hands against her bodice. Her face was blanched white, and her eyes dark and wide with terror.
"You're not," I said. "Unless your uncle finds out you're here, then he'll probably kill you."
"Or does he know?" She shook her head. "No, I didn't tell anyone. I took a public fiacre."
"Why, for God's sake?"
She glanced around like a frightened rabbit looking for a bolt hole, but failing to find one, instead drew herself up and tightened her jaw.
"I had to find Alex. I had to talk to him, to see if he...
Her hands were wringing together, and I could see the effort it cost her to get the words out.
"Never mind," I said, resigned.
"I understand.
Your uncle won't, though, and neither will the Duke. His Grace doesn't know you're here either?"
She shook her head, mute.
"All right," I said, thinking. "Well, the first thing we must do is..." "Madame, may I assist you?"
Mary started like a hare, and I felt my own heart leap uncomfortably into the back of my throat. Bloody footman, never in the right place at the right time.
There was nothing to do now but brazen it out.
I turned to the footman, who was standing stiff as a ramrod in the doorway, looking dignified and suspicious. "Yes," I said, with as much hauteur as I could summon on short notice.
"Will you please tell Mr. Alexander Randall that he has visitors?"
"I regret that I cannot do so, madame," said the footman, with remote formality.
"And why not?" I demanded.
"Because, madame," he answered, "Mr. Alexander Randall is no longer in His Grace's employ. He was dismissed."
The footman glanced at Mary, then lowered his nose an inch and unbent sufficiently to say,
"I understand that Monsieur Randall has taken ship back to England."
"No, he can't be gone. He can't."
Mary darted toward the door and nearly cannoned into Jamie as he entered. She drew up short with a startled gasp, and he stared at her in astonishment.
"What?"
he began, then saw me behind her.
"Oh, there you are, Sassenach. I made an excuse to come and find you. His Grace just told me that Alexander Randall..."
"I know," I interrupted. "He's gone."
"No,"
Mary moaned. "No." She darted toward the door and was through it before either of us could stop her, her heels clattering on the polished parquet.
"Bloody fool!"
I kicked off my own shoes, picked up my skirts, and whizzed after her. Stocking-footed, I was much faster than she in her high-heeled slippers. Maybe I could catch her before she ran into someone else and was caught with the concomitant scandal that would involve. I followed the whisk of her disappearing skirts round the bend of the hall. The floor here was carpeted. If I didn't hurry, I might lose her at an intersection, unable to hear from the footsteps which way she had gone. I put my head down, charged round the last corner, and crashed head-on into a man coming the other way. He let out a startled woof as I struck him amidships, and clutched me by the arms to keep upright as we swayed and staggered together.
"I'm sorry," I began breathlessly. "I thought you were..."
"Oh, Jesus H. fucking Christ!"
My initial impression that I had encountered Alexander Randall had lasted no more than the split second necessary to see the eyes above that finely chiselled mouth. The mouth was much like Alex's, bar the deep lines around it, but those cold eyes could belong to only one man. The shock was so great that for a moment everything seemed paradoxically normal. I had an impulse to apologise, dust him off, and continue my pursuit, leaving him forgotten in the corridor, as just a chance encounter. My adrenal glands hastened to remedy this impression, dumping such a dose of adrenaline into my bloodstream that my heart contracted like a squeezed fist. He was recovering his own breath by now, along with his momentarily shattered self-possession.
"I am inclined to concur with your sentiments, madam, if not precisely with their manner of expression."
Still clutching me by the elbows, he held me slightly away from him, squinting to see my face in the shadowed hall. I saw the shock of recognition blanch his features as my face came into the light.
"Bloody hell, it's you," he exclaimed.
"I thought you were dead."
I wrenched at my arms, trying to free them from the iron-tight grip of Jonathan Randall. He let go of one arm in order to rub his middle, surveying me coldly. The thin, fine-cut features were bronzed and healthy. He gave no outward sign of having been trampled 5 months before by 30 quarter-ton beasts. Not so much as a hoof-print on his forehead.
"Once more, madam, I find myself sharing your sentiments. I was under a very similar misapprehension concerning your state of health. Possibly you are a witch, after all. What did you do? Turn yourself into a wolf?"
The wary dislike stamped on his face was mingled with a touch of superstitious awe. After all, when you turn someone out into the midst of a pack of wolves on a cold winter evening, you rather expect them to cooperate by being eaten forthwith. The sweatiness of my own palms and the drum-like beating of my heart were testimony to the unsettling effect of having someone you thought safely dead suddenly rise up in front of you. I supposed he must be feeling a trifle queasy as well.
"Wouldn't you like to know?"
The urge to annoy him, to disturb that icy calm, was the first emotion to surface from the seething mass of feelings that had erupted within me at the sight of his face. His fingers tightened on my arm, and his lips thinned. I could see his mind working, starting to tick off possibilities.
"If it wasn't yours, whose body did Sir Fletcher's men take out of the dungeon?" I demanded, trying to take advantage of any break in his composure.
An eyewitness had described to me the removal of a rag doll rolled in blood.
"Presumably, Randall, from the scene of the cattle stampede that had masked Jamie's escape from that same dungeon."
Randall smiled, without much humour. If he was as rattled as I, he didn't show it. His breathing was a trifle faster than usual, and the lines that edged mouth and eyes cut deeper than I remembered. But he wasn't gasping like a landed fish. I was. I took in as much oxygen as my lungs would allow, and tried to breathe through my nose.
"It was my orderly, Marley. Though if you aren't answering my questions, why should I answer yours?"
He looked me up and down, carefully evaluating my appearance, silk gown, hair ornaments, jewellery, and stockinged feet.
"Married a Frenchman, did you?" he asked. "I always did think you were a French spy. I trust your new husband keeps you in better order than—"
The words died in his throat as he looked up to see the source of the footsteps that had just turned into the hall behind me.
If I had wanted to discompose him, that urge was now fully gratified. No Hamlet on the stage had ever reacted to the appearance of a ghost with more convincing terror than I saw stamped on that aristocratic face.
The hand still holding my arm clawed deep into my flesh, and I felt the jolt of shock that surged through him like an electric charge. I knew what he saw behind me, and was afraid to turn. There was a deep silence in the hall. Even the wash of the cypress branches against the windows seemed part of the quiet, like the ear-roaring silence that waves make at the bottom of the sea. Very slowly I disengaged my arm from his grasp, and his hand fell nerveless to his side. There was no sound behind me, though I could hear voices start up from the room at the end of the hall. I prayed that the door would stay closed, and tried desperately to remember how Jamie was armed. My mind went blank, then blazed with a reassuring vision of his small sword hung by its belt from a hook on the wardrobe, sun glowing on the enamelled hilt. But he still had his dirk, of course, and the small knife he habitually carried in his stocking.
Come to that, I was entirely sure that in a pinch he would consider his bare hands perfectly adequate. And if you cared to describe my present situation, standing between the two of them, as a pinch?
I swallowed once and slowly turned around. He was standing quite still, no more than a yard behind me. One of the tall, paned casements opened near him, and the dark shadows of the cypress needles rippled over him like water over a sunken rock. He showed no more expression than a rock either. Whatever lived behind those eyes was hidden. They were wide and blank as window panes, as though the soul they mirrored was long since flown. He didn't speak, but after a moment reached out one hand to me. It floated open in the air, and I finally summoned the presence of mind to take it. It was cool and hard, and I clung to it like the wood of a raft. He drew me in, close to his side, took my arm, and turned me, all without speaking or changing expression. As we reached the turning of the hall, Randall spoke behind us. "Jamie," he said. The voice was hoarse with shock, and held a note halfway between disbelief and pleading. Jamie stopped then, and turned to look at him. Randall's face was a ghastly white, with a small red patch livid on each cheekbone. He had taken off his wig, clenched in his hands, and sweat pasted the fine dark hair to his temples. "No." The voice that spoke above me was soft, almost expressionless. Looking up, I could see that the face still matched it, but a quick, hot pulse beat in his neck, and the small triangular scar above his collar flushed red with heat. "I am called Lord Broch Turoch for formality's sake," the soft Scottish voice above me said. "And beyond the requirements of formality, you will never speak to me again until you beg for your life at the point of my sword. Then you may use my name, for it will be the last word you ever speak." With sudden violence he swept around and his flaring plaid swung wide, blocking my view of Randall as we turned the corner of the hall. The carriage was still waiting by the gate. Afraid to look at Jamie, I climbed in and absorbed myself in tucking the folds of yellow silk around my legs. The click of the carriage door shutting made me look up abruptly, but before I could reach the handle, the carriage started with a jerk that threw me back in my seat. Struggling and swearing, I fought my way to my knees and peered out of the back window. He was gone. Nothing moved on the drive but the swaying shadows of cypress and poplar. I hammered frenziedly on the roof of the carriage, but the coachman merely shouted to the horses and urged them on faster. There was little traffic at this hour, and we hurtled through the narrow streets as though the devil were after us. When we drew up in the Rue Trimoulin, I sprang out of the coach, at once panicked and furious. "Why didn't you stop?" I demanded of the coachman. He shrugged, safely impervious atop his perch.
"The master ordered me to drive you home without delay, madame."
He picked up the whip and touched it lightly to the off-horse's rump.
"Wait!" I shouted. "I want to go back."
But he only hunched himself turtle-like into his shoulders, pretending not to hear me as the coach rattled off. Fuming with impotence, I turned toward the door, where the small figure of Fergus appeared, thin brows raised questioningly at my appearance. "Where's Murtaugh?" I snapped. The little clansman was the only person I could think of who might be able, first, to find Jamie, and secondly, to stop him.
"I don't know, madame. Maybe down there."
The boy nodded in the direction of the Rue Gamboge, where there were several taverns, ranging in respectability from those where a travelling lady might dine with her husband, to the dens near the river, which even an armed man might hesitate to enter alone. I laid a hand on Fergus's shoulder, as much for support as in exhortation. "Run and find him, Fergus, quickly as you can." Alarmed by my tone, he leapt off the step and was gone before I could add, "Be careful." Still, he knew the lower levels of Paris life much better than I did. No one was better adapted to eeling through a tavern crowd than an ex-pickpocket. At least, I hoped he was an ex-pickpocket.
But I could worry effectively about only one thing at a time, and visions of Fergus being captured and hanged for his activities receded before the vision Jamie's final words to Randall had evoked. Surely, surely he wouldn't have gone back into the Duke's house. No, I reassured myself. He had no sword. Whatever he might be feeling, and my soul sank within me to think of what he felt, he wouldn't act precipitously. I had seen him in battle before, mind working in an icy calm, severed from the emotions that could cloud his judgment. And for this, above all things, surely he would adhere to the formalities. He would seek the rigid prescriptions, the formulae for the satisfaction of honour, as a refuge, something to cling to against the tides that shook him, the bone-deep surge of bloodlust and revenge. I stopped in the hallway, mechanically shedding my cloak, and pausing by the mirror to straighten my hair. Think, Beecham, I silently urged my pale reflection. If he's going to fight a duel, what's the first thing he'll need? A sword? No, couldn't be. His own was upstairs, hanging on the armoire. While he might easily borrow one, I couldn't imagine his setting out to fight the most important duel of his life, armed with any but his own. His uncle, Dougal Mackenzie, had given it to him at 17, seen him schooled in its use, taught him the tricks and the strengths of a left-handed swordsman, using that sword. Dougal had made him practice, left hand against left hand, for hours on end, until, he told me, he felt the length of Spanish metal come alive, an extension of his arm, hilt welded to his palm. Jamie had said he felt naked without it. And this was not a fight to which he would go naked. No, if he had needed the sword at once, he would have come home to fetch it. I ran my hand impatiently through my hair, trying to think. Damn it, what was the protocol of dueling? Before it came to swords, what happened? A challenge, of course. Had Jamie's words in the hallway constituted that? I had vague ideas of people being slapped across the face with gloves, but had no idea whether that was really the custom, or merely an artifact of memory born of a filmmaker's imagination. Then it came to me. First the challenge, then a place must be arranged. A suitably circumspect place, unlikely to come to the notice of the police or the King's Guard. And to deliver the challenge, to arrange the place, a second was required. Ah, that was where he had gone then. To find his second, Murtaugh. Even if Jamie found Murtaugh before Fergus did, still there would be the formalities to arrange. I began to breathe a little easier, though my heart was still pounding and my laces still seemed too tight. None of the servants was visible. I yanked the laces loose and drew a deep, expanding breath.
I didn't know you were in the habit of undressing in the hallways, or I would have stayed in the drawing-room. Said an ironic Scots voice behind me.
I whirled, my heart leaping high enough to choke me. The man standing stretched in the drawing-room doorway, arms outspread to brace him casually against the frame, was big, nearly as large as Jamie, with the same taut grace of movement, the same air of cool self-possession. The hair was dark, though, and the deep-set eyes a cloudy green. Dougal Mackenzie, appearing suddenly in my home as though called by my thought. Speak of the devil. What in God's name are you doing here? The shock of seeing him was subsiding, though my heart still pounded. I hadn't eaten since breakfast, and a sudden wave of queasiness washed over me. He stepped forward and grasped me by the arm, pulling me toward a chair.
Sit you down, lass, he said. You'll no be feeling just the thing, it looks like.
Very observant of you, I said. Black spots floated at the edge of my vision, and small bright flashes danced before my eyes. Excuse me, I said politely, and put my head between my knees. Jamie, Frank, Randall, Dougal. The flames flickered in my mind, the names seemed to ring in my ears. My palms were sweating, and I pressed them under my arms, hugging myself to try to stop the tremblings of shock. Jamie wouldn't be facing Randall immediately. That was the important thing. There was a little time in which to think, to take preventive action. But what action? Leaving my subconscious to wrestle with this question, I forced my breathing to slow and turned my attention to matters closer to hand. "I repeat," I said, sitting up and smoothing back my hair. "What are you doing here?" The dark brows flickered upward.
"Do I need a reason to visit a kinsman?"
I could still taste the bile at the back of my throat, but my hands had stopped trembling at least.
"Under the circumstances, yes," I said. I drew myself up, grandly ignoring my untied laces, and reached for the brandy decanter. Anticipating me, Dougal took a glass from the tray and poured out a teaspoonful. Then, after a considering glance at me, he doubled the dose.
"Thanks," I said dryly, accepting the glass. "Circumstances, eh? And which circumstances would those be?"
Not waiting for answer or permission, he calmly poured out another glass for himself and lifted it in a casual toast.
"To His Majesty."
I felt my mouth twist sideways. "King James, I suppose." I took a small sip of my own drink and felt the hot aromatic fumes sear the membranes behind my eyes.
"And does the fact that you're in Paris mean that you've converted Colum to your way of thinking?"
For while Dougal Mackenzie might be a Jacobite, it was his brother Colum who led the Mackenzies of Leoch as chieftain. Legs crippled and twisted by a deforming disease, Colum no longer led his clan into battle. Dougal was the war chieftain. But while Dougal might lead men into battle, it was Colum who held the power to say whether the battle would take place. Dougal ignored my question, and having drained his glass, immediately poured out another drink. He savoured the first sip of this one, rolling it visibly around his mouth, and licking a final drop from his lips as he swallowed.
"Not bad," he said. "I must take some back for Colum. He needs something a bit stronger than the wine to help him sleep nights."
This was indeed an oblique answer to my question. Colum's condition was degenerating, then. Always in some pain from the disease that eroded his body, Colum had taken fortified wine in the evenings to help him to sleep. Now he needed straight brandy. I wondered how long it would be before he might be forced to resort to opium for relief. For when he did, that would be the end of his reign as chieftain of his clan. Deprived of physical resources, still he commanded by sheer force of character. But if the strength of Colum's mind were lost to pain and drugs, the clan would have a new leader, Dougal. I gazed at him over the rim of my glass. He returned my stare with no sign of abashment, a slight smile on that wide Mackenzie mouth. His face was much like his brother's and his nephew's, strong and boldly modelled, with broad high cheekbones and a long straight nose like the blade of a knife. Sworn as a boy of 18 to support his brother's chieftainship, he had kept that vow for nearly 30 years, and would keep it, I knew, until the day that Colum died or could lead no longer. But on that day, the mantle of chief would descend on his shoulders, and the men of Clan Mackenzie would follow where he led. After the Saltire of Scotland and the banner of King James, in the vanguard of Bonnie Prince Charlie. "Circumstances," I said, turning to his earlier question.
"Well, I don't suppose one would consider it in the best of taste to come calling on a man whom you'd left for dead, and whose wife you'd tried to seduce."
"Being Dougal Mackenzie," he laughed, "I didn't know quite what it would take to disconcert the man, but I certainly hoped I was there to see it when it finally happened."
"Seduction," he said, lips quirked in amusement. "I offered you marriage."
"You offered to rape me, as I recall," I snapped.
He had, in fact, offered to marry me, by force, after declining to help me in rescuing Jamie from Wentworth Prison the winter before. While his principal motive had been the possession of Jamie's estate of Lallybroch, which would belong to me upon Jamie's death, He hadn't been at all averse to the thought of the minor emoluments of marriage, such as the regular enjoyment of my body.
As for leaving Jamie in the prison, he went on, ignoring me as usual, there seemed no way to get him out, and no sense in risking good men in a vain attempt. He'd be the first to understand that. And it was my duty as his kinsman to offer his wife my protection if he died. I was the lad's foster father, no?
He tilted back his head and drained his glass. I took a good gulp of my own and swallowed quickly so as not to choke. The spirit burned down my throat and gullet, matching the heat that was rising in my cheeks. He was right. Jamie hadn't blamed him for his reluctance to break into Wentworth Prison. He hadn't expected me to do it either, and it was only by a miracle that I had succeeded. But while I had told Jamie, briefly, of Dougal's intention of marrying me, I hadn't tried to convey the carnal aspects of that intention. I had, after all, never expected to see Dougal Mackenzie again. I knew from past experience that he was a seizer of opportunities. With Jamie about to be hanged, he hadn't even waited for execution of the sentence before trying to secure me and my about-to-be-inherited property. When Colum died or became incompetent, Dougal would be in full command of Clan Mackenzie within a week. And if Charles Stuart found the backing he was seeking, Dougal would be there. He had some experience in being a power behind the throne, after all. I tipped up the glass, considering. Colum had business interests in France, wine and timber mostly. These undoubtedly were the pretext for Dougal's visit to Paris, might even be his major ostensible reason. But he had other reasons, I was sure. And the presence in the city of Prince Charles Edward Stuart was almost certainly one of them. One thing to be said for Dougal Mackenzie was that an encounter with him stimulated the mental processes, out of the sheer necessity of trying to figure out what he was actually up to at any given moment. Under the inspiration of his presence, and a good slug of Portuguese brandy, my subconscious was stirring with the birth of an idea. "Well, be that as it may, I'm glad you're here now," I said, replacing my empty glass on the tray.
"You are?"
The thick, dark brows rose incredulously.
"Yes."
I rose and gestured toward the hall. "Fetch my cloak while I do up my laces. I need you to come to the Commissariat de Police with me." Seeing his jaw drop, I felt the first tiny upsurge of hope. If I had managed to take Dougal Mackenzie by surprise, surely I could stop a duel.
"Do you want to tell me what you think you're doing?"
Dougal inquired, as the coach bumped around the Cirque du Mirail, narrowly avoiding an oncoming barouche and a cart full of vegetable marrows.
"No," I said briefly. "But I suppose I'll have to. Did you know that Jack Randall is still alive?"
"I'd not heard he was dead," Dougal said reasonably.
That took me up short for a moment. But of course he was right. We had thought Randall dead only because Sir Marcus MacRannoch had mistaken the trampled body of Randall's orderly for the officer himself during Jamie's rescue from Wentworth Prison. Naturally, no news of Randall's death would have gone round the Highlands, since it hadn't occurred. I tried to gather my scattered thoughts. "He isn't dead," I said, "but he is in Paris."
"In Paris?"
That got his attention. His brows went up, and then his eyes widened with the next thought.
"Where's Jamie?" he asked sharply.
I was glad to see he appreciated the main point. While he didn't know what had passed between Jamie and Randall in Wentworth Prison. No one was ever going to know that, save Jamie, Randall, and, to some extent, me. He knew more than enough about Randall's previous actions to realise exactly what Jamie's first impulse would be on meeting the man here, away from the sanctuary of England. "I don't know," I said, looking out the window. We were passing Les Halles, and the smell of fish was ripe in my nostrils. I pulled out a scented handkerchief and covered my nose and mouth. The strong, sharp tang of the wintergreen with which I had scented it was no match for the reek of a dozen eel sellers' stalls, but it helped a bit. I spoke through the spicy linen folds. We met Randall unexpectedly at the Duke of Sandringham's today. Jamie sent me home in the coach, and I haven't seen him since. Dougal ignored both the stench and the raucous cries of fishwives calling their wares. He frowned at me.
He'll mean to kill the man, surely.
I shook my head and explained my reasoning about the sword. I can't let a duel happen, I said, dropping the handkerchief in order to speak more clearly. I won't. Dougal nodded abstractedly.
Aye, that would be dangerous. Not that the lad couldn't take Randall with ease. I taught him, you ken,
he added with some boastfulness.
But the sentence for dueling...
Got it in one, I said.
All right, he said slowly. But why the police? You didn't mean to have the lad locked up beforehand, do you? Your own husband.
Not Jamie, I said. Randall. A broad grin broke out on his face, not unmixed with scepticism.
Oh, aye. And how do you mean to work that one?
A friend and I were attacked on the street a few nights ago, I said, swallowing at the memory. The men were masked. I couldn't tell who they were. But one of them was about the same height and build as Jonathan Randall. I mean to say that I met Randall at a house today and recognized him as one of the men who attacked us.
Dougal's brows shot up and then drew together. His cool gaze flickered over me.
Suddenly there was a new speculation in his appraisal.
Christ, you've the devil's own nerve. Robbery, was it?
He asked softly. Against my will, I could feel the rage rising in my cheeks.
No,
I said, clipping the word between my teeth.
Ah.
He sat back against the coach's squabs, still looking at me.
You'll have taken no harm, though.
I glanced aside at the passing street, but could feel his eyes prying at the neck of my gown, sliding over the curve of my hips. Not me, I said. But my friend.
I see.
He was quiet for a moment, then said meditatively,
Ever heard of Les Disciples, have you?
I jerked my head back around to him. He lounged in the corner like a crouching cat, watching me through eyes narrowed against the sun. No? What are they? I demanded. He shrugged and sat upright, peering past me at the approaching bulk of the Quai des Orfèvres, hovering grey and dreary above the glitter of the Seine.
A society, of a sort. Young men of family with an interest in things unwholesome, shall we say.
Let's, I said. And just what do you know about Les Disciples?
Only what I heard in a tavern in the Cité, he said. That the society demands a good deal from its members... And the price of initiation is high, by some standards.
That being? I dared him with my eyes. He smiled rather grimly before replying.
A maidenhead, for one thing. The nipples of a married woman, for another.
He shot a quick glance at my bosom.
Your friend's a virgin, is she? Or was?
I felt hot and cold by turns. I wiped my face with a handkerchief and tucked it into the pocket of my cloak. I had to try twice, for my hand trembled. She was. What else have you heard? Do you know who's involved with Les Disciples? Dougal shook his head. There were threads of silver in the russet hair over his temples that caught the light of the afternoon.
Only rumours. The Vicomte de Busca, the youngest of the Charmis sons, perhaps... The Comte Saint-Germain?
Eh,
are you all right, lass?
He leaned forward in some consternation, peering at me. Fine, I said, breathing deeply through my nose. Bloody fine. I pulled out the handkerchief and wiped the cold sweat off my brow.
We mean you no harm, madame,
the ironic voice echoed in the dark of my memory. The green-shirted man was medium height, and dark, slim, and narrow-shouldered. If that description fit Jonathan Randall, it also fit the Comte Saint-Germain. Would I have recognised his voice, though? Could any normal man conceivably have sat across from me at dinner, eating salmon mousse and making genteel conversation barely 2 hours after the incident in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré? Considered logically, though, why not? I had, after all. And I had no particular reason for supposing the Comte to be a normal man, by my standards, if rumour were true. The coach was drawing to a halt, and there was little time for contemplation. Was I about to ensure that the man responsible for Mary's violation went free, while I also ensured the safety of Jamie's most loathed enemy? I took a deep, quivering breath. Damn little choice about it, I thought. Life was paramount. Justice would just have to wait its turn. The coachman had alighted and was reaching for the door handle. I bit my lip and glanced at Dougal Mackenzie. He met my gaze with a slight shrug. What did I want of him? "Will you back my story?" I asked abruptly. He looked up at the towering bulk of the Quai des Orfèvres. Brilliant afternoon light blazed through the open door.
"You're sure?" he asked.
"Yes." My mouth was dry. He slid across the seat and extended a hand to me.
"Pray God we dinna both end in a cell, then," he said.
An hour later, we stepped into the empty street outside the Commissariat de Police. I had sent the coach home, lest anyone who knew us should see it standing outside the Quai des Orfèvres. Dougal offered me an arm, and I took it perforce. The ground here was muddy underfoot, and the cobbles in the street made uncertain going in high-heeled slippers. "Les disciples," I said, as we made our way slowly along the banks of the Seine toward the towers of Notre-Dame. "Do you really think the Comte Saint-Germain might have been one of the men who stopped us in the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré?" I was beginning to tremble with reaction and fatigue, and with hunger. I had had nothing since breakfast, and the lack was making itself felt. Sheer nerve had kept me going through the interview with the police. Now the need to think was passing, and with it, the ability to do so. Dougal's arm was hard under my hand, but I couldn't look up at him. I needed all my attention to keep my footing. We had turned into the Rue Elise, and the cobbles were shiny with damp and smeared with various kinds of filth. A porter, lugging a crate, paused in our path to clear his throat and hawk noisily into the street at my feet. The greenish glob clung to the curve of a stone, finally slipping off to float sluggishly onto the surface of a small mud puddle that lay in the hollow of a missing cobble. Dougal was looking up and down the street for a carriage, brow creased in thought.
"I canna say. I've heard worse than that of the man, but I havena had the honour of meeting him."
He glanced down at me.
"You've managed brawly so far," he said. "They'll have Jack Randall in the Bastille within the hour, but they'll have to let the man go sooner or later, and I wouldna wager much on the chances of Jamie's temper cooling in the meantime. Do you want me to speak to him? Convince him to do nothing foolish?"
"No! For God's sake, stay out of it." The thunder of carriage wheels was loud on the cobbles, but my voice rose high enough to make Dougal's brows lift in surprise.
"All right, then," he said mildly. "I'll leave it to you to manage him. He's stubborn as a stone. But I suppose you have your ways, no?"
This was said with a sidelong glance and knowing smirk. "I'll manage." I would. I would have to. For everything I had told Dougal was true. All true. And yet so far from the truth. For I would send Charles Stuart and his father's cause to the devil gladly. Sacrifice any hope of stopping his headlong dash to folly. even risk the chance of Jamie's imprisonment. For the sake of healing the breach Randall's resurrection had opened in Jamie's mind. I would help him to kill Randall, and feel only joy in the doing of it, except for the one thing. The one consideration strong enough to outweigh Jamie's pride loom larger than his sense of manhood, than his threatened soul's peace. Frank. That was the single idea that had driven me through this day. Sustained me well past the point where I would have welcomed collapse. For months I had thought Randall dead and childless, and feared for Frank's life. But for those same months I had been comforted by the presence of the plain gold ring on the fourth finger of my left hand. The twin of Jamie's silver ring upon my right, it was a talisman in the dark hours of the night when doubts came on the heels of dreams. If I wore his ring still, then the man who had given it to me would live. I told myself that 1,000 times. No matter that I didn't know how a man dead without issue could sire a line of descent that led to Frank, the ring was there, and Frank would live. Now I knew why the ring still shone on my hand, metal chilly as my own cold finger. Randall was alive, could still marry, could still father the child who would pass life on to Frank. Unless Jamie killed him first. I had taken what steps I could for the moment, but the fact I had faced in the Duke's corridor remained. The price of Frank's life was Jamie's soul, and how was I to choose between them? The oncoming fiacre, ignoring Dougal's hail, barreled past without stopping, wheels passing close enough to splash muddy water on Dougal's silk hose and the hem of my gown. Desisting from a volley of heartfelt Gaelic, Dougal shook a fist after the retreating coach.
"Well, and now what?"
he demanded rhetorically. The blob of mucus-streaked spittle floated on the puddle at my feet, reflecting grey light. I could feel its cold slime viscid on my tongue. I put out a hand and grasped Dougal's arm, hard as a smooth-skinned sycamore branch. "Hard!" But it seemed to be swaying dizzily, swinging me far out over the cold and glittering, fish-smelling, slimy water nearby. Black spots floated before my eyes. "Now," I said, "I'm going to be sick." It was nearly sunset when I returned to the Rue Trémoulin. My knees trembled, and it was an effort to put one foot in front of the other on the stairs. I went directly to the bedroom to shed my cloak, wondering whether Jamie had returned yet. He had. I stopped dead in the doorway, surveying the room. My medicine box lay open on the table. The scissors I used for cutting bandages lay half open on my dressing table. They were fanciful things, given to me by a knife-maker who worked now and then at L'Hôpital des Anges. The handles were gilt, worked in the shape of stork's heads, with the long bills forming the silver blades of the scissors. They gleamed in the rays of the setting sun, lying amid a cloud of reddish-gold silk threads. I took several steps toward the dressing table, and the silky, shimmering strands lifted in the disturbed air of my movement, drifting across the tabletop. "Jesus bloody Christ," I breathed. He had been here, all right, and now he was gone. So was his sword. The hair lay in thick, gleaming strands where it had fallen, littering dressing table, stool, and floor. I plucked a shorn lock from the table and held it, feeling the fine, soft hairs separate between my fingers like the threads of embroidery silk. I felt a cold panic that started somewhere between my shoulder blades and prickled down my spine. I remembered Jamie sitting on the fountain behind the Rouen's house, telling me how he had fought his first duel in Paris. "The lace that held my hair back broke, and the wind whipped it into my face, so I could scarcely see what I was doing." He was taking no chance of that happening again. Seeing the evidence left behind, feeling the lock of hair in my hand, soft and alive feeling still, I could imagine the cold deliberation with which he had done it, the snick of metal blades against his skull as he cut away all softness that might obscure his vision. nothing would stand between him and the killing of Jonathan Randall. Nothing but me. Still holding the lock of his hair, I went to the window and stared out, as though hoping to see him in the street. But the Rue Trémoulin was quiet, nothing moving but the flickering shadows of the poplar trees by the gates, and the small movement of a servant standing at the gate of the house to the left, talking to a watchman who brandished his pipe to emphasize a point. The house hummed quietly around me, with dinner preparations taking place below stairs. No company was expected tonight, so the usual bustle was subdued. We ate simply when alone. I sat down on the bed and closed my eyes, folding my hands across my swelling stomach, the lock of hair gripped tight as though I could keep him safe so long as I didn't let go. Had I been in time? Had the police found Jack Randall before Jamie did? What if they had arrived concurrently, or just in time to find Jamie challenging Randall to a formal duel? I rubbed the lock of hair between thumb and forefinger, splaying the cut ends in a small spray of roan and amber. Well, if so, at least they would both be safe. In prison, perhaps, but that was a minor consideration by contrast to other dangers. And if Jamie had found Randall first? I glanced outside. The light was fading fast. Duels were traditionally fought at dawn, but I didn't know whether Jamie would have waited for morning. They might at this moment be facing each other, somewhere in seclusion where the clash of steel and the cry of mortal wounding would attract no attention. For a mortal fight, it would be. What lay between those two men would be settled only by death. And whose death would it be? Jamie's or Randall's? And with him, Frank's. Jamie was likely the better swordsman, but as the challenged, Randall would have the choice of weapons. And success with pistols lay less with the skill of the user than with his fortune. Only the best-made pistols aimed true, and even those were prone to misfire or other accidents. I had a sudden vision of Jamie, limp and quiet on the grass, blood welling from an empty eye socket, and the smell of black powder strong among the scents of spring in the Bois de Boulogne. "What in hell are you doing, Claire?" My head snapped up so hard I bit my tongue. Both his eyes were present and in their correct positions, staring at me from either side of the knife-edged nose. I'd never seen him with his hair so close-clipped before. It made him look like a stranger, the strong bones of his face stark beneath the skin, and the dome of his skull visible under the short, thick turf of his hair. "What am I doing?" I echoed. I swallowed, working some moisture back into my dry mouth. "What am I doing? I'm sitting here with a lock of your hair in my hand, wondering whether you were dead or not. That's what I'm doing."
"I'm not dead."
He crossed to the armoire and opened it. He wore his sword, but had changed clothes since our visit to Sandringham's house. Now he was dressed in his old coat, the one that allowed him free movement of his arms. "Yes, I noticed," I said. "Thoughtful of you to come and tell me."
"I came to fetch my clothes."
He pulled out two shirts and his full-length cloak, and laid them across a stool while he went to rummage in the chest of drawers for clean linen.
"Your clothes? Where on earth are you going?"
I hadn't known what to expect when I saw him again, but I certainly hadn't expected this.
"To an inn."
He glanced at me, then apparently decided I deserved more than a three-word explanation. He turned and looked at me, his eyes blue and opaque as azurite.
"When I sent you home in the coach, I walked for a bit until I had a grip on myself once more. Then I came home to fetch my sword, and returned to the Duke's house to give Randall a formal challenge. The butler told me Randall had been arrested."
His gaze rested on me, remote as the ocean depths. I swallowed once more.
"I went to the Bastille. They told me you'd sworn to an accusation against Randall, saying he'd attacked you and Mary Hawkins the other night. Why, Claire?"
My hands were shaking, and I dropped the lock of hair I had been holding. Its cohesion disturbed by handling,